The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Chris Canangla for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the current issue of Walter Magazine, July of 2026. As you well know, this year marks 250 years since the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Colonial North Carolina was an important player in the American Revolution, and while Raleigh may not have been around at the time, today we house the state cultural institutions that preserve this history. From art to artifacts and through storytelling, events, and exhibits, the city is commemorating the First in Freedom spirit our citizens established in 1776. So how much do you know about the North Carolina signers of the Declaration of Independence? Well, in July 1776, the Continental Congress had been in session in Philadelphia for over a year. It was composed of delegates from the 13 British colonies lining the Atlantic coast from New Hampshire to Georgia. Among them were three founding fathers whom you've likely never heard of: William Hooper, Joseph Hughes, and John Penn. These North Carolinians were among the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence. None of our signatories were originally from North Carolina, but that was not unusual. In the 1770s, it's thought that over half the residents of North Carolina had come from somewhere else, as it was a time of significant population growth and resettlement. People came from other states and abroad seeking land and opportunity, bringing new talents, skills, and ways of thinking. In 1776, William Hooper was a Wilmington lawyer, but he had previously lived in Campbelltown, present-day Fayetteville, and at one time served in Royal Governor William Tryon's legal department. His wife was the former Anne Clark, daughter of a New Hanover sheriff. Born to a prominent Boston family in 1742, Hooper's father was the second rector of Trinity Church. Hooper graduated from Boston Latin for his prep education, then earned both a bachelor's and a master's degree at Harvard University. In addition to his formal training, Hooper studied law in Boston in the early 1760s under Boston lawyer James Otis, who was known for his strong advocacy of colonial rights. At the time of the Declaration, Joseph Hughes was a well-established Edenton merchant who had served in colonial assemblies for 20 years. Hughes was in import-export trading and was a shipbuilder, born on his family's large farm in Kingston, New Jersey. In 1730, Hughes completed his formal studies at Kingston Friends School and was apparently bound for college at Princeton, but in today's vernacular, turned pro instead. Strong-willed and ambitious, Hughes was drawn to commerce and, in lieu of college, sought practical training as an apprentice to a Philadelphia merchant. After 5 years of dock work and learning the trading business from the cargo hold-up, Hughes struck out on his own, at first in Philadelphia. But by 1755, he was making a life and career for himself in Edenton. Hughes was engaged to marry the well-connected Isabella Johnson of Edenton, sister of Samuel Johnson, a future North Carolina governor. The Johnsons' uncle was former royal governor Gabriel Johnston. Sadly, Isabella Johnson died after a short illness before her marriage to Hughes could take place, and Hughes ultimately never married. By 1776, John Penn was a known advocate for independence. Unlike Hooper and Hughes, Penn was not of the eastern North Carolina elite. A Virginia native who grew up on a small farm near the Rappahannock River in Caroline County, Penn was born in 1741 to a hard-working farm family. Though he received little formal education in his late teens, his father's death left him with enough funds that he could afford to take time to study the law. He lived in Granville County in the northern Piedmont, where he farmed and maintained a successful law practice. His wife, the former Susanna Lime, was a native of Granville County, and their marriage is what brought Penn there. He was more typical of backcountry settlers who lived simpler lives and distrusted both the Crown and the eastern North Carolina elite. These three men, Hooper, Hughes, and Penn, were selected by their peers in North Carolina's provincial Congress to represent the state. The primary topic was governance and whether the colonies should seek independence from Great Britain. The colonies had recently ousted royal governors, and now colonial assemblies were trying to figure out how to best govern themselves. But the people were still subjects of King George III, and a good number of Americans liked it that way. Many felt it was beneficial to remain with Great Britain, and numerous English, Scots, and Scots-Irish settlers had known only loyalty to the king. Some historians describe the Revolutionary War as America's first civil war. But news of deadly skirmishes in New England, perpetuated by British troops against local militia, combined with King George III's uncompromising efforts to tax and regulate the colonists, increasingly drove Americans to question their loyalty to the crown. The women of Eastern Carolina were notably engaged in their own protest of the crown and the British Parliament. 51 women, led by Penelope Barker of Edenton, lent their names in the fight against tyranny when they staged the Edenton Tea Party in 1774. Parliament had passed several taxes on imported British goods, and the ladies of Edenton called for a boycott of British imports. As debates about independence crept along in Philadelphia, delegates would come and go, tending to matters at home. Among the dozens of delegates from the 13 colonies, rarely was everyone present at the same time. Travel was hard. The trip by horse from North Carolina to Philadelphia took 2 to 3 weeks. Leaving his family, farm, and practice for long periods, Penn attended more days of the Continental Congress than any other North Carolinian, and was a member of 55 or more congressional committees. Back home, Penn was involved in equipping and supplying both the North Carolina militia and soldiers of the Continental Army. In January 1776, Thomas Paine, a previously little-known writer and thinker, released his pamphlet Common Sense, which strongly advocated for American independence from Great Britain. Written for the masses, Paine called monarchies absurd and implored Americans to unite, proclaim independence, and create a democratic government. His words resonated and spread throughout the colonies. In North Carolina, momentum for self-governance was growing. In May 1775, Mecklenburg County leaders met in Charlotte and publicly resolved their desire for independence. Then, in April 1776, the North Carolina Provincial Congress put forth the Halifax Resolves, in which North Carolina became the first colony to call for independence from Great Britain. Let me read that again. North Carolina became the first colony to call for independence from Great Britain. On July 4, 1776, the Continental Congress set forth the Declaration of Independence, which spelled out grievances with Great Britain and specifically with King George III. The collective body declared the United States of America to be free and independent states absolved from all allegiance to the British crown. The declaration was the seed of the future, but the lowercase U in United meant that each state was sovereign. For the time being, the states would move forward in a loose alliance. That alliance took on the British military, and after 8 years of battles and skirmishes from New Hampshire to Georgia, independence was secured in 1783. The North Carolina trio had challenges during the war. Hooper's home, Finian, was situated on 100-plus acres on Masonboro Sound south of Wilmington. The British bombed and burned Finian, and Hooper and his entire family fled to Hillsborough, where they lived out their lives. During the war, Hughes was in Philadelphia more than in Edenton, often using his knowledge and skill in trade and shipbuilding to help the American cause. He was, in effect, the first Secretary of the Navy. As the war raged, his health worsened, and he grew increasingly weak, probably from malaria. He died in his Philadelphia rooming house in 1779 and was laid to rest nearby in Christ Church Burial Ground, just a few hundred yards from where he signed the Declaration of Independence. Despite their role in representing North Carolina in Philadelphia, Hooper, Hughes, and Penn are relatively unknown today. Though they made continued contributions to the fledgling state of North Carolina after July 4, 1776, all died in their 40s. They never became wildly or widely heralded, though each man is recognized by historical markers and tributes at their graves. Well, while we're still dealing with matters evolving from 1776, here's an article entitled What's in a Name? North Carolina Locales Named After Founding Fathers. While Hooper, Hughes, and Penn aren't well represented in North Carolina, there are many places around our state that got their names from our founding fathers. Among them are the town of Washington on the Pamlico River after, of course, George Washington, and the town of Jefferson in the Blue Ridge after Thomas Jefferson. Franklin County is named for Ben, as is Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. Fayetteville is named for the Marquis de Lafayette, the young French officer who served under Washington. Thanks to a modern Broadway play, practically everyone now knows Alexander Hamilton, and there's a small town named after him along the Roanoke River. Even though he wasn't from North Carolina, General Nathanael Greene has several namesakes here, enough to make other revolutionary leaders green with envy. There's Greensboro, Greenville, and Greene County. They're all named in honor of the general. Additionally, a Greensboro brewer produces Natty Green beer. Cheers! Beyond its signers of the Declaration, North Carolina has produced its share of founding heroes, and some of them are honored with county namesakes. Among them, General Francis Nash, Cornelius Harnett, Alfred Moore, Willie Jones, William Lenore, and Colonel John Sampson. All right, now here's an article that is kind of timely considering the drought that we're under. It concerns the Raleigh Water Tower and the infancy of our municipal water system. The article is called Grand Infrastructure. On September 13, 1887, nearly three dozen intrepid souls ascended the newly completed Raleigh Water Tower on West Morgan Street. They stepped out onto an iron balcony, taking in views from Raleigh's, at that time, tallest structure. The winding stairs, over 100 feet, were counted without a halt, though to some it seemed as if there was no top anywhere. After reaching the top, however, all exertion was amply repaid by the splendid view from the balcony, reported the News and Observer in an article at the time. In the late 1880s, Raleigh's population had only just reached 10,000 people, roughly the size of present-day Wendell. For water, Raleigh residents relied on hand-dug wells or rainwater, with the vast majority of the population either hand-pumping their water or pulling up buckets. If you are wealthy enough to have indoor plumbing, you have an elevated cistern located on the roof or perhaps inside the attic to create the pressure needed to send the precious resource through the plumbing. As reliable municipal water systems became more common in North Carolina cities in the mid-1880s, Raleigh leaders began planning for their own. Raleigh residents practically demanded it, not only for health and convenience, but for fire safety, too. In the first half of the 19th century, there were four major fires on Fayetteville Street, and in 1851, an exceptional conflagration destroyed 17 buildings in the 100 block of Fayetteville Street. This event galvanized the city to improve its firefighting infrastructure, marking the beginning of a fire department organized into companies with a salaried fire chief. Due to limited funds and feeble technology, Raleigh's early water infrastructure consisted of three underground cisterns placed along Fayetteville Street. In the event of fire, a hand-pumped engine would take water from the nearest cistern to hopefully extinguish the flames. The notion of a fire company merely hooking up a hose to a pressurized hydrant on the street and opening a valve would have seemed revolutionary. A municipal water system would eventually achieve this vision. In late 1886, a 20-year franchise was granted to the National Waterworks Construction Company to build, operate, and maintain a system of waterworks for the city of Raleigh. Work on the system began with the purchase of a 30-acre tract of land south of the city where water from Walnut Creek could be impounded, filtered, stored, and ultimately pumped nearly a mile north to a standpipe in the city. Thankfully, the plan for a dull-looking standpipe was quashed in favor of a monumental stone and brick water tower topped with a 100,000-gallon iron tank. Construction on the tower began in March of 1887. Stone contractor Goodwin and Hiss sourced material from the quarry from Raleigh National Cemetery, the same quarry used in the construction of the state capitol. However, only a few weeks into the project. Charles Goodwin became ill, and the outfit withdrew their contract. The partial walls were demolished, and a new contractor began fresh sourcing stone from a quarry near Henderson. By the end of May, the granite base was nearly complete at a height of 30 feet. From there, brick masons took over and laid approximately 150,000 bricks, bringing the tower to a height of 83 feet. Topping it all off was the iron tank. Local boilermaker Robert N. Mitchell set up a temporary forge at the base of the tower, complete with rollers, mills, and a hole-punching machine he had built and designed himself. The massive iron plates, each 5 feet by 8 feet, were wrought into shape, prepared for rivets, and hoisted skyward, where they were hammered into place. Since workers securing rivets were required on both the inside and outside of the tank simultaneously, Mitchell devised a clever solution for those on the interior. A number of watertight wooden barrels were placed in the bottom of the empty tank. Atop the barrels, a platform was constructed, and as each section was complete, water was introduced into the tank that lifted the floating platform for the workers. Now, that's genius. Just under 2 months later, Robert W. Wynn, the 7-year-old son of City Alderman James S. Wynn, was hoisted over 100 feet in the air to ceremoniously strike the final blow on the last rivet. The 2-story brick appendage on the front of the tower was completed just 2 months later. On the ground floor, behind a garage door on the right side, was a real room for the Capital Hose Company firefighters. On the left, the main office for the Raleigh Water Company. The tower continued to serve the city of Raleigh until 1924, even as the population grew over 50%. At that point, the tower was abandoned and sat idle for nearly 15 years. 1938, the city completed demolishing the tower, but Raleigh architect William Henley Dietrich purchased the property, converting it into his office in what many consider to be Raleigh's first example of adaptive reuse. Over the years, many Raleigh landmarks were conceived and brought to life within its 8 walls, including a landmark on the other side of the architectural spectrum, Dorton Arena. After the untimely death of Matthew Nowicki, the building's original architect, Dietrich's firm finished the drawings and saw the project to completion. Today, the Raleigh Water Tower stands as a treasured and unique historic landmark, over the years serving as critical infrastructure, an influential architecture firm, and now an escape room. It's a tangible relic of a much smaller Raleigh. And going back to the theme of the 250th birthday, here's an article called Oaks for America. In honor of the big anniversary, the Rotary Club of Raleigh is planting 250 trees. Heading into 2026, the Rotary Club of Raleigh decided it wanted to do something special for the 250th anniversary of the country. Quote, "Since we are known as the City of Oaks, we thought, well, what better gift could our club give to Raleigh than to plant 250 oak trees in celebration of American independence," says John Cates, the club's fundraising chair. The Rotary Club partnered with the City of Raleigh for this project, with the city managing the trees' locations and planting, and the club providing the funding. The Rotary Club launched the campaign on October 13th with a planting in Moore Square, and since then has planted around 220 trees in Raleigh, with a plan to surpass their goal of 250 trees this fall. Over the last 8 months, they've also had ceremonial tree plantings for special occasions, including one near the Field of Honor in historic Oakwood Cemetery last Veterans Day. In anticipation of Independence Day, the Rotary Club has been decorating the trees around downtown with red, white, and blue ribbons. The idea came from club member Suri Roberts, who recalled how Vietnam veterans returning to the United States were welcomed back with trees lined with yellow ribbons. "It is the act of doing something for others that we hope can inspire and provide hope," Cates said, "knowing that these trees will be around long after we're gone." Well, that is very satisfying. Well, let's turn to some lighter fare now. This is one called Doing the Wave from Ocracoke to Rockingham. Summer comes in waves. "Many years ago," says the author of this article, "I went through a rough stretch, mostly of my own making, and ended up needing to clear my head for a while. I drove alone to the Outer Banks, took the ferry from Swan Quarter to Ocracoke, piddled around in the village for a couple of hours, then aimed the car for Hatteras. Ocracoke tapers to a thin strand that can be secluded even in high season. I found a spot to pull over and step between dunes onto an empty beach, not a soul in either direction. The only sounds were in the wind and the waves, calm and steady, a wet metronome. I got in and rolled in the warm ocean like an otter. Every so often a wave would give me a gentle slap. Snap out of it, son. Everything's going to be fine. The waves are even milder on rivers and lakes, at least usually. When you see white caps on freshwater, you know a storm is coming. That's when you pull up anchor and gun the outboard and hope you get back to the landing before the sky breaks open. Waves can be a warning as well. They can also be a mirage. When I was a kid, I was mesmerized every summer by the shining puddles that always appeared up ahead on the road, only to disappear when we got close. Much later, I found that it's called heat shimmer, and it happens when a surface like asphalt gets much hotter than the air just above it, refracting the light in between. Same thing on sand creates a false oasis, the thing that drives desert wanderers crazy in the movies. That road shimmer was my introduction to the idea that some things in life are always dancing just out of our reach and that maybe they were never really there in the first place. It takes time to learn some lessons. For example, when waves of heat are rising from a car, it's not a good time to sit in the hood wearing shorts. The backs of my thighs learned that one the hard way. Also took time to learn that people in other places don't wave the way we do in the South. This especially applies to what I think of as the two-lane wave, the wave you give somebody when you're slowly passing them in a car. To me, there are a couple of times when that was mandatory. One, if you're out in the country and drive by somebody on the side of the road. Two, if you're on a narrow street or at a four-way stop and somebody lets you through. I live in a neighborhood with a lot of narrow streets, and my experience is that you get the wave about half the time. Every time I don't get the wave, I always wonder where up north the driver came from. This is probably not fair, but barring any proper research, I'm going to roll with it. You might know about the debate over exactly what Bruce Springsteen sings in the first line of Thunder Road. The screen door slams, Mary's dress. What's the next word on the record? It's hard to tell. I've always heard it as Mary's dress sways. Springsteen's manager has said that it's definitely sways. It feels to me like most people's word, the most evocative of many other Springsteen fans, including my dear friend Joe Posnanski, a fellow North Carolinian, swears that the line is, or at least should be, Mary's dress waves. Joe has written thousands of words about this over the years. It is one of those debates that means everything and nothing, much the same way that it means everything and nothing to argue about the greatest baseball player of all time. Joe, who wrote an entire book called The Baseball 100, says Willie Mays, the correct answer is Henry Aaron. Joe has not convinced me on waves and probably never will, but when I play Thunder Road, I always listen close to that first line. Kind of want to hear waves at least one time, not because I want Joe to be right, but because you should try when you can to feel that what someone else feels. I had a neighbor one time who loved to listen to NASCAR on the radio. Every Sunday afternoon in the summer, he would take his old AM-FM portable out to the patio behind his trailer and turn on the race from Rockingham or Martinville or wherever. This was back in the 1970s, and Richard Petty won most of the time. Cale Yarborough and Bobby Allison occasionally gave him hell, and David Pearson lingered in the back of the pack waiting to strike. I wasn't much of a fan of racing, but I was a fan of my neighbor, so sometimes I'd go over there and we'd drink cold Cokes and listen to the howling engines, those sound waves traveling from the track through the radio to our ears, in waves that I still do not fully understand. The one thing waves have in common is that they carry energy. Something desires to get from one place to another, and a wave is the vehicle. That can be a pulse from somewhere deep in the ocean, or the attraction from someone who caught your eye across the room. We are out more this time of year, exposed to the energies of the universe and open to the waves that life brings us. Sometimes they are so powerful they can knock you sideways, but most of the time they're just a pleasant ride carrying us through the shimmer of a summer day and the promise of a summer night. And perhaps finally, unless I'm a little short, we've got about 4 minutes left, this is my favorite article in the magazine. This is called The DMV, Adventures in a License Renewal starring 51 Quarters and a Willie Nelson Lookalike. The week following my 21st birthday, says Louise Gray Leonard, it was the time to tackle the bane of any newly legal adult's existence, a trip to the Department of Motor Vehicles to renew my driver's license. The film Zootopia portrays DMV employees as sloths, painfully slow in completing even the simplest task. But that was not my experience. The people who helped me were quite quick on their feet, and yet, when I arrived in the waiting room, almost every seat was taken, and the line snaked halfway to the door. I grabbed my ticket, took a seat in a concerningly lumpy chair. The man next to me glanced over. The DMV, right? It's the worst, I agreed. He noted that my process would probably be easier because I had a neatly organized folder with all my documentation. I felt a little glow of pride for being well prepared. A few minutes later, my number was called. I handed over my paperwork and answered the questions correctly. For a brief shining moment, everything was going smoothly. The man helping me, we'll call him Mark, informed me that I owed $52.75. No problem, just as expected. Great. Here's my card, I said, smiling. Well, here's the thing, Mark grimaced. Our card reader is broken. He directed me to an ATM two doors down, and I jogged over and pulled out $60 and returned slightly out of breath. I placed the cash on the counter. Mark looked nervous. The thing is, we don't have change, and we can't keep your change because we're state employees, he said. I asked what I was supposed to do and was met with a blank stare and a shrug. That's when my guardian angel appeared from around the corner wearing a neon yellow vest. Hun, we're going to figure this out, she said. I need you to run down to the Family Dollar. Find the cashier who looks like Willie Nelson and have him break one of those 20s. Break him with quarters. We need them. Tell him Sonia sent you. As instructed, I marched to the Family Dollar, found the cashier, who was indeed a dead ringer for Willie Nelson. Hi, I said, flashing a smile. If it isn't any trouble, could you please break my 20 with quarters? We can't do that, he flatly replied. But Tonya sent me. He perked right up. Oh, say no more. Minutes later, I burst back into the DMV with two fistfuls of quarters. I dropped them on the counter triumphantly. Mark sighed and offered a curse. Now I have to count. Close to tears, I offered to help. He took me up on it, and I dutifully counted out $12.75 in quarters, sliding them across the counter one by one while Mark and Tonya watched. 3 hours after my arrival, I finally exited the DMV with a horrendous license photo and a slight headache. On my way out, I saw my friend from earlier, calm as ever. We shared a nod, and I wished him luck. But more than luck, I realized I should wish him patience and a little help from new friends. Okay, well, run out of time for today's episode of Walter. We hope you have enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Chris Canangla, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Walter is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.